What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hi, I'm Chris Cotnor, executive producer of the DSR Network. We've been incredibly busy here over the past month. With the launch of TNR's Daily Blast, we now produce 10 shows covering foreign policy, national security, domestic politics, cyber and tech, legal, and much more. We've also just launched our redesigned website at thedsrnetwork.com. With all of this content, there has never been a better time to become a member. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for nearly all of our shows, early access to episodes, enhanced show notes, and access to our exclusive DSR Slack community. Membership is just $7 per month or $70 per year. To become a member, please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you very much for your support.
This is the Daily Blast from the New Republic, produced and presented by the DSR Network. I'm your host, Greg Sargent. In recent days, Donald Trump opened the door to cutting Social Security if he's reelected president. He's also threatened to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which would throw millions of people off of health insurance, something the Biden campaign is now hammering relentlessly in new ads. All this comes as Biden's economy is, by many metrics, doing quite well. Yet the polling remains stubborn. Trump is favored on the economy over President Biden by lopsided margins. Biden's economic approval remains in the toilet, and Trump's support among many of his voters remains solid, even though his policy threats would almost surely be terrible for many of the aging blue-collar whites that make up his base. What explains these disconnects? New York Times columnist Paul Krugman has written a series of columns lately looking at our collective amnesia about the COVID-fueled economic catastrophe of 2020, Trump's last year in office, and all the ways the Trump GOP economic policy threats would screw over the MAGA base. So we invited him back on the show to discuss all these issues. Welcome, Paul.
Hi there.
So let's talk about 2020. This year is suddenly central to the 2024 campaign. Trump is asking pretty much daily whether we're better off than we were 4 years ago, and the Biden campaign is aggressively reminding people of how terrible 2020 truly was for our country. Are we suffering from a kind of collective amnesia about that, and why is that so dangerous to hopes of defeating Trump this time?
Yeah, we do seem to be suffering from some amnesia. People, when asked, how you were doing 4 years ago, respond really with how you were doing sort of in December 2019, or actually a somewhat idealized version of how you were doing in December 2019, because the current economy looks as good or better than that of even pre-pandemic. But then I think a lot of people have just sort of shut down. It was a very traumatic period, and people don't kind of write it off or don't want to think about it. It's like everything was put on hold, including their memory during the periods of lockdowns and isolation.
I do think that Trump actually benefits from another weird feature of all this, which is that people on some level still think that we were just uniformly struck by some external disaster and don't really connect what a calamity it was for the country to his terrible dereliction in office. So all this amnesia, I think, is dangerous to any hopes of defeating Trump this time, don't you think?
Oh, sure. I mean, if you want to know, often the question in advance for someone who's running for president is how would that person respond to a major crisis? Well, in the case of Trump, we know. He was given a lethal crisis. He responded with denial, dereliction, fantasy solutions, and probably thousands for sure, probably hundreds of thousands of Americans are dead because of Trump's bad response. And yet somehow that has been erased from a lot of people's memory. They don't remember how absolutely horrifying it was to watch the president of the United States sort of refusing to deal realistically with this public health crisis.
Speaking of the dynamics that favor Trump, unfairly, I think, Trump is also threatening a new round of trade wars. And in one of your columns, you wrote about a new study on those trade wars that shows that the ones during his presidency didn't boost manufacturing employment overall and, quote, has not provided economic help to the U.S. heartland. Yet the study also finds that in areas whose industries were protected by Trump's tariffs, people were more likely to vote for Trump and Republicans, even though those policies didn't boost employment. Can you talk a little about that study?
Yeah. So this is the latest, and there have been many studies now about the Trump tariffs, and which did not. It's pretty clear that it did not actually boost manufacturing employment, partly because it's a misdiagnosis. There was never any good reason to think that tariffs would do very much for manufacturing, and also because the Trump tariffs were really incompetent. The design of them did more to raise the costs of manufacturers by raising the price of steel, for example, than it did to help them by protecting them from foreign competition. So all of that, what this study does, this new study, and this is by people I take very seriously, they try to break it down regionally and show that even in the sort of decaying manufacturing rust belt, if you like, that the tariffs didn't actually do anything for the manufacturing base. You know, but by contrast with, by the way, Biden's industrial policies are actually doing a substantial amount for exactly that area, for that manufacturing base. But a lot of what people apparently respond to, especially the kind of people who are at least susceptible to being Trump voters, is they respond to kind of the vibes. Trump sounded like he was getting tough on foreign competition. Sounded like he was, punishing those foreigners who are taking away our jobs. And that's what resonated, even though in concrete terms, he didn't do anything for the people involved. So that's kind of distressing, especially because that's the whole thing. I mean, Trump, I get really annoyed at the way everybody now calls Trump a populist, because he hasn't actually done anything that you would consider populist in the normal sense. He actually, you could only wish that his economic policies were as pro-worker as, say, Viktor Orban in Hungary or something. You know, other populists in other countries at least have an occasional gesture towards actually doing something towards the working class voters who support them. Trump has, the only thing that he did that is not straight line right-wing Republican orthodoxy was the tariffs, and they didn't actually help his base at all.
Right. And to your point about what Biden has done, I think we should put down some markers here. Well, maybe you and I shouldn't, but some other pundits should. Right. We've been told for years that Trump voters stick with him due to economic anxiety or because he's willing to take on economic elites and their shibboleths in ways that neither party, including Democrats, have been willing to do. But to your point, now we're seeing Biden rebuild the manufacturing base, and his investments are creating lots of new manufacturing jobs in areas that Democratic and liberal elites supposedly abandoned. And this is advanced manufacturing work benefiting lots of people without college degrees. All this is stuff Trump was supposed to do. Blue-collar wages are rising. So if Biden's numbers don't move among non-college white voters after all this, what can we take from that?
So I actually have a somewhat nuanced view here. I don't think that the economic anxiety, as people used to say, maybe still do, that's irrelevant to the Trump phenomenon, because I do think that the collapse of the old manufacturing economy, the collapse of coal mining and all of that did create a climate in which something like MAGA could flourish. But it wasn't really that Trump was coming up with any solutions. What happened was that you get this disgruntled group of people who, look, most people don't understand policy. And, you know, and rightly so. People have lives to live. They don't have time to do the kind of wonkish policy analysis or even read it that those of us who do it for a living do. So they get kind of impressions. And what happened was that people feeling bad about their lives, people feeling bad that elites had somehow betrayed them, are open to this kind of demagoguery around taking on the elites and the globalists, even though substantively there is nothing to it. And Trump in practice, I think a really crucial thing to understand about Trump is that he's doesn't understand himself about policy, doesn't really care about policy. I mean, we can get into this a bit more, but he probably knows less about how U.S. government policy works, how our major programs work, anything than that, than your average reader of the New York Times does. And so he's not actually interested in policy. And in practice, he governed, except for the tariffs, which is just a particular obsession, he basically outsourced all actual policy to ideological hardline right-wing Republicans in Congress. So what you actually got was the Trump administration might as well have been a Paul Ryan administration plus tariffs.
Right. And on that score, we're seeing Trump right now promise to revive exactly the policies that he pursued during his first term that sided with the Paul Ryans in his party and the plutocrats in his cabinet. He's floating cuts to Social Security. He's threatened to repeal Obamacare. And wouldn't these policies sell out Trump's blue-collar white base perhaps as much or more than any other demographic?
Oh, sure. I mean, if you ask, we're long past the days when it was actually really never true. But if you ever thought of the U.S. social safety net as being something that was for non-white urban people, that's not at all true now. Now it's very much the people who really depend on this stuff, whether it's, of course, Social Security, blue collar workers that is what their retirement plan. They don't have pensions. They don't have significant 401ks. What they have is Social Security. Medicare, the Trump base is relatively old. They're not going to, the kind of people who are going to have retirement plans that come with healthcare. So Medicare is their retirement healthcare. Even Medicaid is now very widespread. Food stamps are a prime source of support in a lot of the American heartland for less educated workers. So these are the people who would really be very badly hurt by the Republican Study Committee agenda. But they don't seem to know. They don't know that that's what a second Trump administration would mean for them.
Well, in a way, Trump keeps the scam hidden. I mean, it's a big scam, right? He's out there bashing China's production of cars as a threat to the U.S. auto industry, slamming Biden's climate agenda as a threat to working people, and vowing across the board 10% tariffs. And when he opens the door to cuts to Social Security, he says absurdly that immigrants are threatening the program, which kind of wraps his Social Security talk in MAGA packaging in a way. So in a pretty comprehensive way, he's hiding the truth about what a Trump and GOP Congress agenda would do vis-a-vis working people, right? I mean, it's a scam and he's hiding it, right?
Well, it's sometimes it's hard to tell when Trump is being dishonest and when he's just being ignorant, if I can say that. When he says that migrants are killing Social Security and Medicare, on the one hand, that's absurd. If you know anything at all about those are programs that basically collect payroll taxes from working age people and use them to support seniors. Adult immigrants are overwhelmingly working age. So the immigration is actually one of the key things that sustaining these programs. So that's totally wrong. How much of that is Trump just cynically saying, migrants are, like part of his demonizing of migrants? And how much of it is that he just actually hasn't the faintest idea how America's most important government programs work. And my guess is it's both, that he probably doesn't care how they work, but he also probably doesn't know how they work, which comes back to my point that in practice, then if in power again, he doesn't know how to draft legislation or how to deliver instructions on legislation, he's going to outsource it. He's going to the hardliners in the Republican Party who do understand how these programs work and want to kill them will end up dictating what the policy actually ends up being.
I mean, in a sense, he's victimizing his own voters with what can really only be called a massive scam, no?
Yeah. Well, I mean, his whole life has been one scam after another, and that this is now the biggest of them all. No, this is an enormous, it's really amazing. I mean, if you compare, I mean, there are vaguely MAGA sounding right wing parties in Europe, but most of them actually have a little bit, not an excuse for something like the FN in France or the current government in Italy, but they have at least a trace of actual concern for the people who voted them into power. Trump has none of that. It's all, I'm on your side, I'm your kind of guy, and he's already signaled that he's actually going to destroy your retirement.
And I think a key component of that scam, right, is that he perpetually promises a kind of strongman rule that will protect people from an array of economic enemies, whether it's China, right, or electric cars or immigrants, what have you. I think the enemy part is far more important than the economic part of Trump's messaging. Yet there is this economic component, as you point out, even if in policy terms, it's largely a smokescreen for the opposite. And I wanted to ask you, do Dems bear some responsibility here in failing to adequately explain to people how their policies will protect them from the vagaries of capitalism, which, look, their policies often do seek to do that to a far greater extent than anything Trump and Republicans offer, right?
Yeah, I think there is. It's funny. I don't think that Biden is doing a particularly bad job, but he's on explaining, but he is inheriting a bit of a legacy here. If you go back, to the Obama administration, most of the bad things that happened to working class Americans actually did happen under previous Republican administrations. The Obama administration was kind of globalist. Obama was, I think, too much under the influence of the kind of we must maintain open world markets, which is all important. But if you remember, Obama was really trying hard to negotiate the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade agreement that wasn't going to do terrible things, but it was not, given the obvious political threat in the United States, and this was not something to be spending political capital on. So there was a pretty strong. The last Democratic administration was very strongly influenced by a kind of narrow, technocratic, pro-globalist view that has a lot going for it, except it's not what swing voters want to hear about. It's not, they want some sense that you are fighting for them, for them, not just, sort of for global efficiency. And the funny thing is that now we have a lot of my friends in the economics area are upset about Biden's economic nationalism, are upset about Biden is waging a much tougher sort of economic cold war with China than Trump ever did. But that is a hard message to get across. And but they're trying. I think they are willing to do that. And disregard the people who say, you mustn't say such things because, gosh, we all know about the benefits of free trade and economic nationalism is bad. And, not as much as people think. And we're at a pretty critical point on domestic politics.
It does seem as if the Democratic Party has adjusted to some degree. I think sometimes it's overstated in the sense that people kind of ascribe that to a reaction to Trump, when in fact, a lot of these currents already existed in kind of the various think tanks and other organizations that make up the constellation of progressive economic DC, right? I mean, a lot of these ideas have been swirling around for a while. It really wasn't just a reaction to Trump. It might be worth them setting the record straight on that.
Yeah, I mean, if you know the paper that showed that Trump's policies didn't actually help the heartland economically, most of the people who wrote that are the same people who kind of upended a lot of the economics discussion on trade with their discussion of the China shock, the way in which the flood of imports from China, mostly during the Bush administration, by the way, really did displace substantial numbers of U.S. manufacturing jobs. So this is, and this, they are, I don't know, I actually don't know where the authors are politically, but their works get cited a lot by progressive economists in D.C. So this is, we're not talking at all now about knee-jerk, free trade, globalist types. The people, we probably would have had an evolution in this direction regardless. And as I say, I mean, if you actually start to look at how Biden is dealing with China economically, it's a very confrontational policy, especially on the technology side, aggressive enough that it makes, I support it, but it makes me a little bit nervous because they're taking such a tough line. And, you know, Trump, after huffing and puffing, basically kind of left the Chinese off the hook if they bought some more soybeans. So it's amazing the reality of, you know, who is actually tough on foreigners who may on foreign regimes that may be posing some kind of threat. It's overwhelmingly Biden rather than Trump.
You know, the China shock stuff actually brings me to something I wanted to ask you about. The economics writer Noah Smith said something interesting about that. There is a new China shock coming, and it could upend our politics again. I think it's fair to say that Democrats and liberals did get caught off guard, as you point out, by the political impact of the last China shock. So what can we learn from that? What's your take on how we should prepare for the coming China shock's political effects?
Trump's tariff proposals are, you know, completely not thought through and not clear who would be thinking it through. Maybe Peter Navarro is thinking it through while he's in jail. But the possibility that we may need to threaten tariffs, I think, is there. I mean, we can go through, you know, endlessly about the virtues, the long-run virtues of free trade. But here we have, you know, China's in trouble. And China, when we talk about the new China shock, we're talking about the rather strong possibility that China is going to be trying to export its way out of its current malaise. And China is now such a big economy that if they try to do that, the impact on the rest of us is severe. And you might say, well, you know, we'll be getting lots of cheap stuff from China. Isn't that an offsetting benefit? But the trouble is, what I learned from the original China shock analysis was that what we had failed to understand was the extent to which the adverse impacts of a flood of imports are concentrated, particularly concentrated geographically. That you can say, oh, well, you know, America's a big country, there's always churn. Even in good times, 1.5 million people are fired every month. So what difference does a few hundred thousand jobs make? But if those few hundred thousand jobs are in a specific communities, and they basically rip the heart out of particular communities, then it's a serious problem. So I don't think, you know, China's not going to be allowed to do this. One way or another, we are not going to allow China to try to export its way out of this this morass that they've fallen into. And I think that will be true if Biden's reelected as well.
And so you don't think there's some sort of prepping we need to do for a coming shock and the ways in which it could politically upend everything here?
Well, I think we may be, we might want to have politically, I don't think this is a discussion that is even going to register with the general public right now. But I would, right now, all eyes on our own election. But I think we do need to say that the There's a big debate to be had, I think, particularly within a kind of progressive economics commentariat about what are we willing to do? This is an area where there are real arguments among serious people, and a lot of people, I think, are still stuck in a sort of pre-China shock mindset, are not ready to acknowledge that we may well be in a situation where we just are not going to be able to play by those rules anymore. But the people who are not in that mindset are the kind of progressive economists who actually work in the Biden administration. We've got a set of very much more flexible people, much more skeptical about sort of blanket free trade arguments than many economists still are. And as I say, if you look at people really should follow the technology conflict with China. The Biden administration policies are really, really tough. I mean, we're basically not just saying don't dump cheap stuff and undermine our industry. We're basically, the Biden administration is actually trying to limit Chinese technological development. That's a hell of an aggressive policy. I favor it, but it is anyone who thinks that Biden is some kind of globalist cat's paw should look at what we're actually doing with respect to China.
There's an irony to all this, I think, which is that Democrats are constantly kind of whacked for supposedly misunderstanding the true nature of Trump's appeal to his voters and so forth. And yet, if anything, the Biden administration, particularly a certain set of advisors around him, and many Democrats in Congress have really internalized the lessons of the last 20 years and are acting on them in a big way.
Yeah. Now, the question is, does that work politically, or does it work politically in time for November? And I think there's good reason to be somewhat disappointed that the huge surge in manufacturing investment that we've seen that is very directly attributable to Biden policies isn't having more of an impact, that most voters probably don't know about it. Partly, of course, because Republicans in Congress who voted against it then go out there trumpeting the new investments in their districts. So I'd had hopes that there'd be more immediate political payoff than there has been. But it will take, I think it will eventually have some payoff, but probably not this year.
I had hoped for the same thing, and it really is distressing to not see it take effect. On the other hand, they have 8 months and many hundreds of millions of dollars to try and make those things take effect, so hopefully they will. Paul Krugman, thanks for coming on today. We really appreciate your insights.
Okay, thanks a lot, and take care.
Folks, don't miss two new pieces up at TNR.com. Jason Lincoln's on why Democrats have to stop waiting for the courts to save them from Trump, and Michael Tomasky on how the media is totally missing the real story of the Biden economy and whether that real story will actually matter to voters. We'll see you tomorrow. You've been listening to The Daily Blast with me, your host, Greg Sargent. The Daily Blast is a New Republic podcast and is produced by Riley Fessler and the DSR Network.